Hi there. You're listening to Philosophical Discursions, the podcast accompanying the blog Philosophical Disquisitions. In today's episode, we're going to take a look at a classic contribution to the 20th century philosophy of religion, Anthony Flew's short paper, Theology and Falsification, as well as the various responses to it. Please visit the blog at philosophicaldisquisitions.blogspot.com for a link to the items discussed in today's episode, as well as other articles on the philosophy of religion, science, ethics, and society. So today is a real piece of philosophical nostalgia because we're going all the way back to post-war English academia, to the heyday of ordinary language philosophy, and we're going to take a look at a symposium centering on a paper by Anthony Flew entitled Theology and Falsification. The original symposium had three participants, Anthony Flew, Orem Hare, and Basil Mitchell. As far as I can tell, based on my limited internet-based research, no one is quite sure when the symposium took place. Different dates are given in different sources, but the best source I could find suggests that it took place actually back in 1944 or 1945. It's certainly listed as taking place then in the Proceedings of the Aristotelian Society, but it wasn't published until the early 1950s. It's been republished in many forums since then, and I'll be posting a link to a version on the blog anyway, so not to worry. Okay, so the podcast is going to follow the structure of the original symposium. We're going to look at Anthony Flew's paper first, then Orem Hare's response, and then Basil Mitchell's response, and then Flew's response to those responses. I will also, as a special treat, take a look at a further response to Hare's argument, published a few years later, and I may even go the extra mile and provide some reflections of my own at the end. Okay, so let's kick things off by looking at Flew's paper. One interesting feature of all the papers presented at this symposium is that they build arguments out of parables or thought experiments. And Flew's thought experiment is very famous, and it goes something like as follows. Two explorers come upon a clearing in the woods. The clearing contains a mix of flowers and weeds, but is very beautiful and is enough to stop the explorers in their tracks. The first explorer decides that there must be a gardener tending to this clearing. The second explorer, being of a more skeptical bent, thinks that there is no such gardener, that the arrangement of flowers and weeds is just the workings of chance. To settle the dispute or disagreement that has arisen between them, they decide to hang around and see if a gardener will ever show up. So they wait, and they wait, and they wait, and nobody ever shows. The first explorer is not dismayed by this turn of events, because he has decided that the gardener is invisible, and not the kind of person we would expect to see. The second explorer, again, being of a skeptical bent, thinks that there is still a way we could detect an invisible gardener. He proposes that we put in place an electrified fence, or alternatively, a patrol of guard dogs. So the idea here is that an invisible man would still make contact with a fence, or emit some scent that could be detected by the guard dogs. So they try this out, and still no success. No gardener is ever detected. The first explorer, again, is not dismayed by this turn of events, because he has decided that the gardener is actually an invisible, intangible, incorporeal, and immaterial being, not the kind that we could detect with any of our physical tools like electrified fences or guard dogs. The second explorer raises a skeptical eyebrow at this and asks, well, what's the difference between a non-existent gardener and an intangible, incorporeal, immaterial, and invisible gardener? I mean, there's no way for us to decide between the two of them. Now that's where the thought experiment comes to an end, but obviously there is an implication here that religious statements, religious claims, are much like the claims of the first explorer in respect to the gardener. They start out being explanations or statements of fact, but then they undergo, as Flew puts it, death by a thousand qualifications, and they end up being vacuous or meaningless. Now, although it's not stated in formal terms, there is clearly an argument behind Flew's paper. And what I want to do now is try and reconstruct that argument in more formal terms. So we begin with a fairly obvious premise. It says, for an utterance or statement to count as an assertion or explanation, it must exclude at least one possible state of affairs. In other words, for something to have empirical content or even theological significance, it can't be consistent with everything that we would observe. There must be some evidence that would count either against it or in its favor. The second premise, then, is that religious utterances or statements at least purport or pretend to be explanations or statements of fact. In other words, taking them at face value, we should not expect them to be consistent with every possible state of affairs. The third premise, then, is that in practice, religious utterances or claims are consistent with every possible state of affairs. So if a religious believer proclaims that God exists or that there is some divine purpose to the universe, no evidence that we present them with could possibly dissuade them from continuing in their proclamations. So, since these statements are consistent with every possible state of affairs, and since for a statement to be meaningful or to have empirical or theological significance, it can't be consistent with every possible state of affairs, we must conclude that religious utterances or statements are vacuous, devoid of any meaningful content. Now, I just want to make a couple of comments about that argument, because the way I've phrased it is, I think, a little bit more favorable to Flew than other interpreters are inclined to be. For a start, I'm not really interpreting this as an argument about the meaning of religious statements. I think meaning is a rather difficult concept to pin down. What I'm really interpreting it as is an argument about the empirical or theological significance of religious statements. In other words, if religious statements are trying to explain states of affairs, they can't do it if they are qualified in such a way that they're consistent with every possible state of affairs. And likewise, if part of the theological claim is that there is a being worthy of our worship, then statements about that being that are consistent with every possible state of affairs can't contribute to making it the case that such a being exists. Now, those of you who have been listening to other podcasts in this series will realize that that is an echoing the argument of Steve Mateson in relation to divine command theories of morality. So I would suggest listening to that episode to get a feel for what the concept of theological significance is all about. Now, I haven't completely eliminated the possibility of interpreting it as an argument about religious meaning, but I think the strongest interpretation and the most favorable interpretation leans towards the explanatory and theological significance of religious statements. Okay, so that's Flew's initial contribution done and dusted. We're going to move on now to consider Orem Hare's response to Flew. Hare basically begins by conceding ground to Flew. He says that, so if religious utterances are explanations or statements of fact, then Flew is correct in thinking that they tend to undergo death by a thousand qualifications. So what Hare does instead is he argues that religious utterances are not primarily explanations or statements of fact. They are something quite philosophically distinct. Now, what that is, he's not sure, but he's going to give it a rather strange name, and he's going to call it a blick. So religious statements are blicks. Now, this raises the obvious question, what is a blick? Hare kind of elaborates and illustrates the concept with a couple of examples. So he asks us first to imagine a madman who believes that all the Oxford dons are trying to kill him. We can assume here that Hare lived a very cloistered academic life during which the college authorities were the primary existential threat. In any event, Hare says that we could present evidence to the madman suggesting that his original claim is wrong. We could show him that the Oxford dons have never been anything other but unfailingly polite and nice to him. But the madman would surely respond by saying, well, actually, that's just more evidence of their true deviousness. They're lulling me into a false sense of security before they bump me off. Now, Hare's point here is that the madman is clearly deluded, but he's not clear that he's deluded about the way he explains or states facts about the world. He thinks that the madman really has the wrong set of blicks. Now, I don't know if that example clarifies what a blick means to you. I'll certainly have the occasion to criticize it towards the end of this podcast. In the meantime, we'll move on to the second of Hare's examples, which relates to his beliefs about the safety of the steering wheel in his car. And he says that there's a certain probability that the steering will fail every time he sits into the car and drives, but that he himself has no way of knowing when that probability or when that chance reaches one. Nonetheless, he continues to have faith in the quality and reliability of the steering. So this set of beliefs is, again, a blick for Hare, because it's something that is significant, but is not capable of being falsified or upset by evidence. Again, I'm not sure about the cogency of that particular example, but I do think that the third example that Hare gives touches upon something quite interesting. And he says that statements like everything happens for a reason or everything happens by chance are blicks, because when you think about it, there's no evidence that could count in favor or against those statements. the first claim that everything happens for a reason is quite ambiguous, quite opaque, and I'm sure with a sufficiently inventive imagination, we could come up with a reason for everything happening. And likewise, the statement that everything happens by chance, there's nothing that could confirm or deny that, because the idea of chance is sufficiently ambiguous to encompass every possible state of affairs. Nonetheless, these claims that everything happens for a reason, or that everything happens by chance, have huge philosophical significance for how we understand and approach the world. So I think this actually does help us to get a formal definition of a blick. And what I've come up with myself is that a blick is any utterance or claim that is not capable of falsification or verification, but is still a significant part of how we view or understand the world. It's a significant component in our worldview. So Hare intends this as a response to Flew's original paper, and what I want to do now is try and reconstruct the argument that is inherent in what he has to say. It begins with a premise about Flew's argument. It says that Flew argues that religious utterances are assertions or explanations, and that as assertions or explanations they fail because they cannot be falsified due to their endless qualification and their consistency with every possible state of affairs. Furthermore, Flew concludes from this that because they cannot be falsified, religious utterances are meaningless, empirically vacuous, or theologically insignificant. Hare responds to this with a premise of his own, that an utterance or a claim need not be falsifiable in order to be meaningful or theologically significant, and that there are some utterances, he calls them blicks, that are not falsifiable but are still a significant part of how we view and understand the world. Furthermore, he adds to this the assumption that religious utterances are more akin to blicks than they are to assertions or explanations about the actual state of the world. So we get from this the conclusion that even though religious statements are not falsifiable, they can still be significant. There are a couple of things we should be concerned about with this argument. First of all, we want to know whether Hare has defined the concept of a blick in a sufficiently precise and unambiguous manner. I'm not convinced that he does, and I want to come back to that issue at the end of the podcast. We should also worry about whether religious statements are, in fact, closer to being blicks than they are to being assertions or explanations. Again, we'll come back to that later. Okay, so now we're going to move on to Basil Mitchell's response to Flew's paper. Mitchell's response is not as philosophically exciting as Hare's response, but it does point to a key component of religious belief, namely the role that faith plays in religious approaches to evidence. So Mitchell begins his paper with a parable about a member of the French Resistance during World War II. Of course, this was written around the time of World War II, so the parable no doubt had greater resonance then than it does now. Nonetheless, we contemporary 21st century people can still appreciate it. The parable goes as follows. A member of the French Resistance one evening has a chance encounter with a rather impressive stranger. After a long conversation, the impressive stranger reveals to the member of the Resistance that he is in fact the leader of the Resistance, and that no matter what happens in the coming months and years, the member is to have faith in the impressive stranger, have faith that the stranger is doing what is ultimately right for the Resistance. Because he is so impressive, the member of the Resistance is willing to go along with this request. The two never meet in person again, but in subsequent months he occasionally sees and hears reports about the stranger's activities. These reports are a mixed bag. Sometimes the stranger appears to be helping the Resistance, and sometimes he appears to be hindering or harming the Resistance. The member also asks the stranger for help on occasion, and again there's a mixed bag. Sometimes assistance is received and given, and sometimes it is withheld. Despite this, and despite the mixed bag of evidence, the member continues to have faith in the stranger, even though his friends are trying to convince him that the stranger is a wily double agent. The member thinks that the original encounter, and the faith that he received in that original encounter, sustains him against the battery of contradictory evidence that he is being presented with. Now, obviously, Mitchell is pointing to a direct analogy between the faith in the stranger and the faith of the religious believer in God. Now, the point of this paper is to basically agree with Flew that religious utterances or claims are explanations or assertions or statements of fact, but that one's approach to contradictory evidence depends largely on one's faith in those original utterances or claims. And because the religious faith is so strong, they are particularly impervious or immune to evidence. Now, I guess that there is a further presumption underlying this, that at some level, the religious attitude towards evidence is rational, or could be rational. And I think this could be connected with Alvin Plantinga's idea of properly basic, warranted religious beliefs. Or maybe even William Lane Craig's internal witness of the Holy Spirit, how that provides a really firm epistemic starting point, which then affects your approach to evidence and argument. And I'm going to put up a video of Craig talking about this in the post that accompanies this podcast. Now, personally, I can't see how this is a rational position to hold, but that's an argument, I think, for another day. Okay, so we've now reached the end of the original contributions to the symposium, and we're going to look at Flew's responses to Hare and Mitchell. Looking to Hare's argument first, Flew concedes that the concept of the Blick might have an important role to play in philosophy, but he doesn't think it has an important role to play in the philosophy of religion, because he thinks that religious utterances are very clearly not blicks, so claims about the existence of God or the resurrection of Jesus or something like that cannot plausibly be interpreted as anything other than statements of fact or explanations of fact. They are certainly not these abstract, non-falsifiable, but still significant components of a worldview that Hare seems to think they are. And so the point that Flew wants to make is that Hare is really propounding a radically new and distinct type of theology. Now, turning to Mitchell's argument, Flew has the following to say. He thinks the attractiveness of what Mitchell has to say depends largely on the analogy between a member of the resistance and the faith he has in this impressive stranger, and a religious believer and the faith they have in God. And he thinks that this analogy just doesn't stack up for the following reason. It might be reasonable for the member of the resistance to have faith in the impressive stranger, because there are excuses that can be granted to mortal, fallible human beings. So because even though the stranger is behaving in a somewhat ambiguous manner, we might be inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt. The same excuses don't apply to an omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent being, because being perfect and all-knowing, we should expect God to send us clear, unambiguous evidence of his existence. Now, I have to say, I can imagine religious believers getting their hackles raised about that, because they would say that the omni-properties of God actually pull us in the opposite direction to from that which Flew is trying to pull us in. They would say that those properties make us less likely to understand what God is up to, and less able to tell whether evidence really contradicts his existence or not. So I feel that Flew is a little bit lacking in his responses. So I did hunt down another response to Hare's argument, this one written by a guy called, well, I'm not sure if it's a guy, but I presume it is, H.J.N. Horsberg. And Horsberg focuses on this concept of the Blick and has four observations to make. First, he thinks that the concept of the Blick is poorly defined. So if we return to Hare's examples of what a Blick was, we find that there are important differences between them. In particular, there is a very striking difference between the madman's beliefs about the Oxford Dons and claims such as everything happens for a reason and everything happens by chance. Specifically, there is a difference between something that is what Horsberg calls a pure Blick and an impure Blick. If you recall, a Blick is something that is unfalsifiable but forms a significant part of our worldview. Now, an impure Blick is something that is only artificially unfalsifiable, falsifiable due to its endless and constant qualification. So, for example, the madman's beliefs about the Oxford Dons constitutes an impure Blick, because he's always dismissing or coming up with some excuse for dismissing the evidence that is presented to him. By way of contrast, a pure Blick is something that is genuinely unfalsifiable due to its very nature. It's not the kind of thing that touches upon or depends upon matters of fact. So Horsberg thinks that a claim like everything happens for a reason is a pure Blick, because it's not the kind of claim that depends upon empirical contingencies. So the point here is that Hare is playing a little bit fast and loose with his own terminology, and by playing fast and loose, it allows him to strengthen his claim that religious utterances are Blicks. In reality, Horsberg thinks that they are, at best, impure Blicks, claims that are rendered artificially unfalsifiable due to constant qualification. The second observation that Horsberg makes is that an impure Blick is intolerable because it is an unfalsifiable claim that's masquerading as an explanation. In other words, it pretends to explain some state of affairs when the evidence is in its favour, but then it just dodges the bullet of falsification through redefinition whenever the evidence is going against it. If we accepted impure blicks, we'd completely undermine the process of scientific investigation and explanation, because this process relies on the fact that potential explanations are open to falsification. The third observation that Horsburgh makes is one that I already alluded to, namely that religious claims and utterances are in fact impure blicks. So a statement like God exists, God created the universe, or God is love, are at best artificially unfalsifiable. Now, I agree with this insofar as it goes, but I can see how something like God is love could be easily transformed into a statement like everything happens for a reason, and the latter statement then would be a pure blick. Now, the problem with that transformation is that a claim like everything happens for a reason may be devoid of theological content, because it says nothing about the types of reasons that lie behind everything. For all we know, based on that claim, the reasons could be good or bad, but they very definitely need to be good if we are to support the existence of a God. Now, the final observation made by Horsburgh is actually quite interesting, and it's to do with the relationship between the historical claims of religions that certainly cannot count as pure blicks, or blicks of either form, really, and the parts of religion that may qualify as impure or pure blicks. And he says that if religious beliefs are to be amalgams of blicks and non-blicks, then it will be difficult to stop the non-blicks being transformed into blicks. Now, I'll concede that all this talk of blicks might be a little bit confusing, but I think the idea here is actually somewhat intuitive and is something that you may have come across before, namely that you know a person who accepts claims that are stated within the Bible initially on historical grounds, but when they are presented with historical evidence that contradicts those claims, they retreat to saying something like, well, no historical evidence could ever contradict the internal witness of the Holy Spirit or the profound religious experience that I have undergone whenever I read the Bible. In other words, the claims that were initially supported on the grounds of historical evidence have become detached from the evidence in the manner of a blick. Okay, so that's pretty much everything. I suppose I will close with just a couple of reflections of my own. First, I want to throw my support behind Flew's argument that there is something suspicious about many religious claims and assertions, namely that they tend to be empirically and theologically vacuous. Two examples from my own reading spring readily to mind. The first is something I encountered when reading Gregory Dawes' book, Theism and Explanation. He pointed out there how most proponents of theistic explanations will strategically avoid making specific claims about what God's intentions might be and how those intentions explain the observable evidence. This allows them to cope with any evidence that is thrown in their direction and really means that their purported explanation is empirically vacuous. A noteworthy proponent of this strategy would be Richard Swinburne, who, because he couches his argument in the language of probability and confirmation theory, gets to avoid boring down into the nitty-gritty of what God is trying to achieve when he creates the world or provides us with religious experiences. Another example of the problem with religious claims comes from skeptical theism and the problem of evil. So obviously the problem of evil is a classic objection to theism, and many believers will respond to this objection by appealing to God's wholly other transcendent nature. Transcendent? I don't think that's a word. But anyway, you get the idea. Because of this nature, God has full access to the realm of good and evil, whereas we, limited human beings, have only a small, limited access to the realm of good and evil. And this means that we can never really know whether something is truly good or bad, and so we can't say whether the problem of evil actually works. Now, certainly that can save the possibility of a God, but it leaves us with an entity whose merits we are unable to assess. And why should we spend our lives worshipping such a being? I think that's an interesting observation about how religious claims shift in response to evidence and argument. And I think it is a serious challenge to the quality and cogency of religious belief. So I think Flew, even though his paper has its flaws, stumbled onto something very important, and maybe that explains the popularity of his piece after more than half a century. I'm inclined to leave it there, but alas, I can't, because Flew, who died recently, became a little bit notorious in his later years for changing his mind ever so slightly on the God issue, becoming more open to the possibility of a deistic life and universe-creating entity. A set of tributes to Flew were published in the last edition of Philosophy Now, the June-July 2010 edition, and I thought I might read from the last paragraph of one of them, which kind of sums up the shift in Flew's thinking and relates it back to the theology and falsification argument. So it goes, in 2003, Flew again hinted that his opinions about religion might be shifting. He said that he would write a Philosophy Now article outlining his new thinking. The article eventually arrived, and I set to work editing it. This is written by the editor of Philosophy Now. However, when he wrote back approving the proof copy, Flew asked me to put it on hold, saying that he had a new edition of his book God and Philosophy coming out from Prometheus Press shortly, with a preface outlining his new position, and didn't want to steal their thunder. The article, which Flew had pulled, was lucid and elegantly written. Flew's main point in it was that while completely accepting Darwinian evolution for the development of species, he couldn't see how the first self-reproducing life had appeared on Earth to kick off the whole process of evolution. This, for Flew, was finally the footprint of the gardener. Now, I'm certainly not inclined to agree with Flew's reasoning there, and I think there are quarrels we could have about Flew's lucidity in his final years, but I think that's a topic best left to another day. Thank you.